Curious Conversations About Sex is brought to you by Curious Creatures, who run a variety of workshops on self-development and sexuality in Australia. My name is Rog. Today, we're chatting about gender and how your identity is influenced by the events you experience in your life. The conversation is especially interested in how minority genders, such as non-binary and trans identities, are formed, and how there's healthy and less than healthy ways that that plays out. There's also a ton of stuff in there that's relevant for everyone. My guest is Avi Seketapulu, who, along with Anne Pellegrini, has recently written a book called Gender Without Identity. Just one note before we get into it. A couple of times, my guest talks as if there's the cis community and then there's the gender exploring community. And it possibly comes off as if a cis person can't also be a gender exploring person. I don't at all think that that's what my guest thinks. I think it's just where the conversation went based on the language we were using up until that point. So we kind of kept on with that language, even though it didn't match the point that was being made. And just as an example of that, there's myself. I am both cis and gender questioning. So for me, it's useful to separate out my physical body or sex, you might say, from my personality or maybe gender, you might say. So on a physical level, I am totally cis male. I didn't used to think I was, but I totally am. This body's fine for me. But on a personality level, or like, I guess, more around identity or personality stuff, psychology, I'm non-binary. I after my explorations, I feel like I would rather not have a gender. Thanks anyway. It's important to me, well, you know, because I'm in that camp, but also because I never want to come across to you like I'm dismissing any gender identity. So obviously that includes trans and non-binary folks, but it also includes all of you beautiful cis folks. So, with that said, let's get into a curious conversation about sex and gender. Avi, great having you with us on Curious Conversations About Sex, or Curious Conversations About Gender, as I suspect the case is going to be.
That's right.
So with Anne Pellegrini, you've recently written the book Gender Without Identity. Can I just sort of start at what I hope is the start? And the name implies for me that gender and identity are separate, and I know for myself they're kind of often infused. Can you tell me a little about, gender without identity, or identity without gender, or how that makes sense to you?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that question. It's actually a critical part of some of the points we're making in the book. So I'm happy to start from there. And to start by making a distinction between how we experience things, which is that each of us experiences our gender as being part of our identity. For some of us, that's more salient. And for some people who don't think very much about their gender, usually people who identify as cis, kind of like one's identity, kind of like gender, experience of their gender feels like an identity that is just there, does not even need to be thought about or fleshed out, as opposed to people who are trans.
It's sort of assumed to be obvious, and why would we be even having the conversation?
Exactly. As opposed to people who are trans or non-binary or otherwise gender non-conforming, who kind of like have to articulate themselves to themselves as having a gender identity. So for sure, like, just to kind of like be very clear from the beginning, what the book and what we are not trying to do is tell people how to think about themselves, or tell people that the way that they're thinking about themselves is right or wrong. What we're trying to do is actually do something quite different, which is to help clinicians and those who think in our culture about gender to become a little bit less fixated, if not attached, to the notion that a gender can only be valid if it is attached to an identity, if it is your true self. And we use the word identity in the way that it is used in most contexts to capture something that is very true to the self, very kind of like oftentimes innate, oftentimes understood as being critical to one's kind of like very sense of being. So to kind of like give you a little bit of a sense of like where we're coming from with that, kind of like we're both clinical psychoanalysts, and my co-author Anne Pellegrini is also an academic. I also do academic work. But part of what we found in doing our clinical work is that there's more or less like two major strands of thinking when it comes to kind of like gender. There is the kind of like the born this way argument that kind of like assumes that everybody's born into their gender and into their sexual orientation for that matter. And some genders are more oppressed than others. So for example, cis people are born into their gender, but they get to have their gender, but trans people are not born into their gender because they're not born, or so the story goes, into the body that should fit their gender. And instead what they have to do is actually make claims for them. And that is what I would say is like, it's a progressive narrative, right? It tries to accord gender non-conforming people the same validity to their gender as cis people have, based on the fact that everybody's born this way.
Yeah. Okay.
On the other hand, I'm going to say this really quickly, and I know you want to ask a question. On the other hand, we also have kind of like the more transphobic, homophobic, and generally anxiety-ridden argument that only cis and straight people are born into their genders and their sexualities. Everybody else has been warped out of their true gender, which is assumed to be cis and binary. So you have the born this way argument, and then you have the warped this way argument, meaning that kind of like trauma or being at the wrong bar or at the wrong internet site or having the wrong teacher, the wrong books is what's happening this day in the States, kind of like is what makes you queer. And therefore, if only these resources can be contained or prohibited, then everybody's going to be what they are ostensibly truly at core, which is cis and straight. So you have like these two arguments, like born this way and warped this way. And our argument in the book is that neither of the two is definitely warped this way is very problematic, but that born this way actually doesn't take us very far either.
Okay. So many juicy things to explore further there. Couple of side thoughts. I was thinking about how when you speak about, these are not your words, but how a person that discovers that they're not cis sort of doesn't have the choice of not looking into gender and gender issues, and has almost like a journey that's somewhat laid out ahead of them in terms of defining and having their gender understood. And there's pluses and minuses to that, because that means you get to have a journey into gender and you get to find out more congruently what your gender and identity actually is. But there's obviously an incredible downside in that it oftentimes does feel like a battle. So that was one thought. I also had a quick laugh because we had about a 30-second hello before we pressed the record button, and I introduced my gender and I said I'm non-binary, but as a sex educator, I often try and deliver that with a sense of humor so that people don't get caught up and distracted in that and having a fear that they don't know what's going on, which I suspect is a little of what you're trying to address with the therapeutic community. Like the therapeutic community, so this is the bit that is about to become a question. The therapeutic community can sometimes get a little caught up and distracted on gender identities, and it sounds like part of your message there, if I'm hearing it right, is, hey, it's still just a human. Don't get too caught up on that. Or did I mishear that?
No, that's actually quite right, that part of what we're trying to do is make room for the variety of gendered experience that comes with human life. And to do so without trying to help clinicians who are thinking expansively to become less anxious about the question of like, how does somebody have to come to acquire the gender that they have? So we make an argument that is somewhat counterintuitive for people who are not transphobic or kind of like advocating conversion therapy, which is that we start with the premise that there's nothing wrong with being queer or trans or gender non-conforming, that there's no wrong way to be queer or trans or gender non-conforming, and also that there's no wrong way to become queer or trans or gender non-conforming, which is another way of saying that that we, as especially those of us who work in the clinic, Seeing patients, especially seeing children who are the epicenter right now of all of these moral panics about this panic that girls are being made to transition because they have internalized homophobia, that part of the argument that we're trying to make is that it's okay to be able to think complexly about varied ways in which people arrive at their genders. And rather than a notion that there is a true gender that clinical work or exploration needs to uncover, and then when it's uncovered, one you have a sense of what needs to happen for you to live in your gender. Like, you decide what it is, and then you have the right pronouns, and you have the right medicalizations. And this, of course, does not just apply to trans people. Like, for example, cis women medicalize themselves all the time. This is what, for example, premenopausal women, hormone replacement therapy is exactly a medicalization of gender that is actually quite acceptable. We just don't think of it as medicalization. So, so the idea is that once you have your gender down, you know what it is, then there's a number of technologies, discursive technologies, relational technologies, medical technologies that all fall in place. But we have not found this to be true in the clinic. We see people who routinely come in and in the privacy and safety of a consulting room begin to tell wildly more diverse stories than the ones that are often offered to clinicians or rehearsed for the favor of politicians, legislators, teachers, therapists, doctors. And the stories that we are hearing are have a larger breadth of what we are coming to see creates different genders. And I want to say, my co-author, Dr. Anne Pellegrini, and I are also members of the queer community ourselves. And that really accords with what we see in our communities, in our social lives. So there's no, it's not like we see something in the clinic that is entirely surprising. But we do not have theories, definitely in psychoanalysis and in clinical psychology and the mental health fields, that help clinicians and parents think how it is possible for one's gender to not be a core part of the self, but to be valid merely on the basis of how it is experienced.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned that more nuance and complexity turns up in the consulting room around people's experiences and discussions about their gender. Would you almost say that people are not defined by a simple take on their gender?
By what? That
by a simple people? By a simple take on their gender. Like, I mean, we as a gender movement, by which I'm dating back to, say, the 1950s, we have been saying we are not defined by our gender. We are more than that. So,
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, in some ways, genderqueer people can't get it right as far as conservatives are concerned.
Yeah.
If they're defined by their gender, that's a problem because that's too limiting. And if they're not defined by their gender, why are they paying so much attention to their gender? These kinds of conversations don't go very far. So what we have wanted to do, rather than engage them and have more debate about them, debate that has been had in the literature and has not taken us very far, we want to refuse the terms by which they offer the conversation, because those terms are actually not, they're not hospitable to queer and trans life.
It's in some ways, it's a very polarized debate between two groups of people, one who want things to be simpler and more categorizable and perhaps also fitting with what they already understand, and another group who wants to see complexity and nuance and almost like confusion. Well, it serves me. I like having a confused perspective about my gender and the way I see other people's genders. I like to be confused and to not know. I feel like I'm more likely to see the individual. But anyway, it's the debate is quite polarized along those lines a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I really love what you're saying about how confusion is also the place where we have more space.
Yeah.
And where we do not need to really fit into very clearly delineated roles, but actually confusion can be very generative.
I love it when we're talking about gender and someone says, I don't know. I just feel like there's a huge amount of space in that.
Yeah. But you see, I think that in some way, another way to frame what we're polarized around as cultures right now is I don't think that we're polarized so much about how to see gender. I think that we're polarized around issues of control around gender.
Say more.
There are groups who see that confusion as cause for alarm and therefore as requiring interventions that control gender outcomes or control gender expression. And then you have other people who are much more comfortable with the process of experimentation that is by necessity involving all human life, including gender. Like there's a panic, especially when I speak to fellow colleagues who are worried that that kids are transitioning too early, that they have too easy access to hormones, which is a lie, actually. It's a lot of work for a child to even be able to come to. I work with children, and I know this from my own clinical experience. For a child to be able to come to an adult and say that, to announce themselves as who they understand themselves to be, is not a simple project. That does not mean that it may not be an experimental project, that the child may not be trying things out, and we allow that for children all the time. But that's where we come back to the question of like how adults and how cultures, legislators, teachers, schools, clinicians engage with this experimentation and this inventiveness is what seems to be polarized. The question of do you allow it to happen or do you try to control it and shut it down?
Hey there, listener. I'd like to make you a little proposal. I love making this podcast for free because it helps me spread the word about sex positivity. But I could use your help in spreading the word just by sharing this episode if that's not too absurd. For every 10 stories that you listen to, please recommend it to someone that might like it too. This is not a real contract, for you got no say. I would if I could frame it some other way. And if sharing's not for you, that's fine. There's nothing to do. Please listen without guilt to this podcast I built. I love what you're saying about control. It rings a bell, and it gets me to thinking about understanding those that we don't agree with. And I feel like throughout watching the debate around, as it was phrased at the time, same-sex marriage, there was a sense, there was that same sense of the mainstream or the historical perspective having a sense of losing control. And there's always the question of, well, what does it matter? What does it matter what happens in people's bedrooms, in private spaces? Why is that a control threat? And likewise, I think certainly with my own non-binariness, I notice that the world often has that, or some of the world often has that same sense of like, I can see in them a sense that they're losing control of something. What do you think? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on what that's about and what people think they're losing control about and why a person's individual choices come across as a threat to control?
Yeah, I actually have given this a lot of thought along with other colleagues in psychoanalysis. And this is where psychoanalysis and the concept of the unconscious really helps. Because I think it's not, so there's kind of like two different directions we can take with this. And I think that both apply. The one is that, especially when it comes to children, a lot of colleagues in the field, I'm thinking of the work of Jules Gill-Peterson, of kind of like many people who are writing about childhoods and are speaking about how kind of like adults tend to have a propertarian relationship with children, as if children are adult property and need to be managed wisely. I am a child psychologist, so I do not minimize that children are not just miniature adults, that they have kind of like particular sets of needs and particular sets of developmental processes that need to be respected. But that said, I cannot tell you how many parents I have spoken to in the course of my practice, or have heard supervisees discuss in consultation with me, who actually override the child's developmental processes in order to produce results that are more consistent with what the parent thinks is going to be a good life. And, you know, oftentimes these parents are very well-meaning. They think that they're doing the best for their child. So I'm not here talking about necessarily like pathological parents. So that's one strand. So that's one way of thinking about control. Another way is that I think that being in the presence of somebody who's like, I'm going to talk mostly about gender now, even though I think that some of this also applies to sexuality and polyamory and other kinds of sexual interests. Being in the presence of somebody who is experimenting within gender and has done something with it, which is quite different than what we've been taught by culture is the way to be, is a really, like, it causes a revolt. Kind of like it stands to this, to kind of like disturb also whatever stability is one thing one has for themselves. So trans people always pose the question of why cis implicitly, just by virtue of existing. And I think that this makes a lot of people who have never given much thought to their gender, or people who have struggled with gender but have kind of like really either suppressed it or turned it into something that feels very solid to them by kind of like dissociating or performing all kinds of psychic amputations of themselves. Like, this can be, in a way, the return of the repressed, being in the presence of somebody who is trans or somebody who's non-binary. So the way to push down whatever is coming up in oneself can get externalized and projected into the other and become a way of controlling the other's effervescence, the other's richness, the other's complexity, because it poses an imagined threat to the self because of the contact with one's own normativity.
Yeah, nice. And I guess it's also an extension of the heritage of sex education such as it is. So most people are brought up in a very controlling sex negative world where they are very sternly taught what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do, shamed for the times where they've tried adventures or followed their creativity. So most of us are, monkey see, monkey do. We repeat it on. So I guess the...
And I was going to say, like, you know, not out of like a lack of interest in exploring, but because, if you think about children are incredibly curious and versatile in their gender interests, in their engagements with ways of being. And it is us adults who put limits around that.
Yes, and almost all teenagers either do explore or want to explore sexually outside of the bounds of what's normal for the culture they're in. Normally it's only a matter of time before that gets squashed.
But in some way, like, I think that one of the most counterintuitive arguments that we make in gender without identity is the idea that not only is this kind of like wide range of exploration something to not be defensive about or anxious about, but even trauma may have something to do with the formation of gender.
Oh, I really want to get to that in just a second. We put a pin in that because I've got something else I'm dying to ask you about first, which is what's the gender exploring community got that could be of benefit to the mainstream? And what's the mainstream got that could be of benefit to the gender exploring community?
Well, I think that what the gender exploring community understands, because in some ways they have had to in trying to navigate a world, a cis world in a non-normative gender, is that the gender system is an entirely arbitrary system, which does not mean that one can fully escape it. It doesn't mean that it's fully in one's control. It's not like if you realize that something is arbitrary, you get single-handedly to do it differently, but it does give you a little bit more room to move.
It's like any other decision in life. There's almost like sometimes those moments of choice where it's just like belief, and you can either stay within a system or you can choose to be outside of that system. And it is never that easy, because you can't just decide to be a free, liberal, whatever person and step outside of 9 to 5 or whatever. But on another level, you can. So likewise with gender, to a degree, it's a choice. I love what you're saying. Yep.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting though, because I think that the word choice is an important one to clarify here, because kind of like when we're talking, at least when I'm talking about choice in this sense, I am not meaning this in the context of like somebody wakes up in the morning and chooses their gender in the way we choose what kind of coffee we're going to have.
Thanks for the clarification on that. I appreciate that.
What you might choose is whether you suppress your gender, whether you express your gender, or how you express it, or what you do with it, whether you let it take you in a direction of kind of like communal life, or whether you do it privately, how it relates to your sexuality. These, to some degree, can be conscious choices. But one does not choose their gender any more than one chooses their character.
So maybe it's more a little like, it's not so much about choosing gender as like choosing to acknowledge the gender that you have that's trying to actually emerge. So I imagine posing this question to, let's say, people who wouldn't identify as part of the gender exploring community. A person who might just say, well, yeah, no, of course I'm a man, or of course I'm a woman. Like, you know, why even the question? The set of socialization and conditioning that comes with those two roles, speaking on the binary for a moment, like chances are a whole bunch of that is going to be feel right for the person that's answering that question, but it's never going to be all of it. There's no chance that everyone is always going to love all of the cluster of personality traits and limits and opportunities in this world that come with their gender. So to a degree, there's choice involved in terms of, right, you don't have to be entirely polarized and just on that spectrum. You can choose to bring in more parts of your real self. But yeah, it's not so much a question of like you can keep on flipping and changing your mind, and some of those things will be innate to who you are, but they may have nothing to do with how your gender presents. I've gone off on a bit of a meandering track.
Well, I have a thought, if you want to kind of like stay in that place for a moment. Like when you talk about like kind of like also changing your gender, like that's this emphasis on how gender is mutable is part of why we have felt the need to disconnect the notion of gender from the notion of identity. Like, for example, right now, there is a lot, part of where the discourse is tilting in critiquing gender complexity is in talking about what has come to be called the detransitioners. And detransitioners are people who have transitioned or had some degree of like either medical or social transition out of their assigned gender, and who now understand themselves, who have understood themselves as being trans or non-binary, and who then have moved away from that identification. And detransitioners are now used, if not weaponized, to prove that many trans people don't get it right, that they don't know what their gender is, and that they got it wrong. And the implication is that they got wrong, that they're trans, they're really cis, is what kind of like the whole argument around the transitioners go. And therefore, if some people can get it wrong, then everybody could get it wrong. And therefore, we need to double down on who we allow to transition, what kids should have access to medical care. This is especially pernicious argument in the domain of thinking about trans healthcare for children and underage people. But what this misses is that all to call somebody who moves away from their transition a detransitioner is to miss that gender is for many people a constant evolution, and that some people do not detransition but retransition into a different gender that is often not a cisgender either. Or if somebody oftentimes, you know, because of varied reasons why people detransition, like transphobia, social pressures, difficulty finding employment, kind of like carcerality, race, class. I mean, all of these issues play into that. Somebody who detransitions may still even people who compress themselves into binary gender and say, you know what, I got it wrong, I really was the gender that I was assigned at birth, will then continue to say things that kind of like almost leak out of them about how they still have fantasies about being of a different gender than their cisgender, or they still have parts of themselves that don't fully align. So we kind of like, part of the argument we make in Gender Without Identity is for moving away from thinking of gender as legitimate only in the context of whether it reflects some core part of the self, and granting the dignity of belief and the dignity of recognition to gender just on the virtue of how it is experienced by an individual at the moment.
Yeah.
Without
yeah.
requiring some like hard kind of like innate core that is yeah. verifiable, say by genes or chromosomes or even yeah. like early experience that to prove the truth of one's gender.
Love what you're saying about when someone detransitions, we don't know what that's about. I'm reminded that transitioning is not a perfect, clean clinical mm-hmm. experiment. It would be a cleaner experiment if you could transition and be in a community that accepts you as you are and that is not transphobic and where things are more straightforward. I think that same issue gets missed in the question of sometimes the right will draw attention to higher suicide rates after transitioning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's impossible to separate how much of that is a discomfort and a dissatisfaction with finding yourself in a world where you now don't have the option of getting away from how much discomfort and loathing there is towards you and what you stand for.
Transphobia, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so likewise, yeah, detransitioning yeah, I mean, is, you don't know whether that's a plea to move away from a decision or whether it's a plea to move away from the culture you find yourself in and how unsettling yeah. that is.
But even the citation of kind of like studies that show that trans people are no more happier after transitioning, I mean, there's a lot of data that actually shows that this is not true, which is not to imply that transition that we should expect as a criterion for a good transition, somebody being kind of like happy, like transition, just like any other part of life, also involves misery.
Yeah.
And misery is caused by a number of different things, some of which have to do with transphobia. That to, you know, you may come out, just to give an example that is more familiar to some people, it's not 100% parallel, but there are some overlaps. You know, somebody can come out as gay, still experience homophobia. Like, nobody's saying that if you come out as gay, you're going to be living happily ever after. This is a homophobic world. And the same goes with transition. So this fantasy that kind of like, or this burden that we put on trans people or on methods for kind of like trans research, that we expect perfect outcomes. Like, what area of medicine do we expect perfect outcomes in? You know, yeah. regret levels for knee surgeries hover around 10%. You know, regret rates for medical interventions for trans people are like significantly lower than that. But these become very phantasmagoric, ostensibly objective measures of measuring if somebody has successfully transitioned or not, that they prior attention away from where it should be, which is the quality of somebody's living, the relationship of their gender to their autonomy, to the exercise of their autonomy. Gender is one of the ways in which we exercise our autonomy in the world.
Yeah, nice. And more broadly, if we're using instances of someone changing their mind about something as evidence that that choice is incorrect for all people, there's a lot of stuff that we'd have to question, like, for instance, monogamy, because I knew someone that once got into monogamy and it turns out they didn't like the person they were with. So does that disprove all of monogamy? And I've known some people with buyer's regret after having kids. So would that undermine that as an institution? I think not.
Exactly.
So I humbly submit that the same logic should be applied to gender questioning world.
Yeah, I mean, regret is not as we fear. an indication of a mistake. It's how life is lived. Like, it is human to have regret, which is not to minimize the fact that it's not to say, like, who cares? Like, it's not to be nonchalant about medical transition, especially with children. It's to actually be a little bit more careful with the different kinds of criteria that we apply to some experience, non-normative experience, as opposed to normative experience. We do not take somebody who regrets having married somebody, as you were saying, as to be evidence that we should now question the whole institution of marriage.
Yeah. Awesome. That was all from the question around what do the gender exploring communities have that might be of benefit to the mainstream. Do you have any thoughts on the other way around? And then I do want to get to the point around how trauma potentially informs gender and gender identity.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a really interesting question, because there's nothing that cis communities have that gender nonconforming people are not already exposed to.
Except maybe acceptance.
Just by virtue. Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, you mean, like, is there something that they would enjoy that cis people enjoy?
Like, I guess I didn't actually.
Tell me, maybe you should tell me differently what you mean. I want to understand how you meant that.
I don't think I had a specific spot I was going with it. I just know that always in a conflict, in a polarized situation, there's oftentimes something that each side has that the other would like. So I love what you were saying about the mainstreams. If we can get past the polarization, the mainstream has the potential to benefit from what comes with gender exploring and looking into that to find out what one's gender identity actually is, even if it's just to come back and land on going, you know what, I'm so 100% cis and so happy with my binary. But yeah, I'm always curious about the other. I'm always trying to understand where the opportunity for peace there is. So yeah, what was my answer then? I said something about, I think the mainstream has the capacity to offer acceptance and normalcy. I mean, that is something that my community needs and wants.
Yeah. Well, I think it's complicated, because, you know, when you say normalcy, like, one way to think about, the way that I would think about that is that what cis people get to have that trans people, but that few trans and gender queer people get to have, is like the lack of hypervisibility. The kind of, like, they can just be left alone.
Yeah.
In ways that trans and gender queer people. Yeah, they get to, like, not have to constantly explicate themselves, or that's not because they're not doing gender. It's because the codes for gender are pre-understood and often not even communicated well and misunderstood, but these misunderstandings can stand. Whereas when it comes to transness or gender queerness, they can't. But I also want to flip that on its head and say that I also know a lot of kind of, like, people whose genders are kind of, like, well outside the binary, who feel that they are actually not interested in normalization, that they're not interested in this kind of kind of, like, disappearing into the group and feeling that they don't stand out, but who enjoy the process of their difference, who enjoy the strangeness and the campiness of their genders, however much it stands out. Yes, of course, sometimes it attracts unwelcome attention, kind of, like, legal attention, pathologizing attention, criminalizing attention. But there's also communities that have actually thrived historically on these kinds of differences and have created really robust collectives that kind of, like, actually generate a lot. I mean, think about kind of, like, voguing and kind of, like, Black cultures of genderqueer people, and the sheer amount of envy that they have generated in kind of, like, white cis people, to the degree that it becomes, like, a kind of, like, a sellable product when Madonna is kind of, like, putting up her song, and then you have all kinds of, like, cis straight people trying to, like, imitate the genre. So while we want to pay attention to kind of like the injury and the pain that comes with queerness and with gender nonconformity, I think we would be remiss to also not pay attention to the joy and to all the ways in which kind of like the excitement, the pleasure, the expansiveness, the creativity, and the resistance to being assimilated into kind of like a into something that can be invisible.
Yeah, nice. It's a double-edged sword. There's pluses and minuses to uniqueness and being part of a specific and defined and separate community. I'm thinking a little for some reason about the punk movement in the 70s in particular. And for many people, myself included, it's the point of difference is the point of difference is being different. Let's talk about trauma. So let me just pause a little second. I just always want to go slow when talking about trauma. It's easy to get it's easy to get excited about the cerebral aspects. So I just want to support myself to go a little slower and give due attention. So this is very much a question, not a statement. You're drawing connections between saying gender identity can be sometimes informed by trauma. Do you want to like say that in words that are more accurate for you and maybe tell us a little more about that? Maybe like some examples of how that plays out.
And I have to say that the argument is like so counterintuitive and I think also so dangerous that I want to be very careful. So I have to apologize in advance for kind of like giving like going into a little bit of a monologue about this. So please interrupt me where you feel you want to. But let me start with saying that one of the things that we noticed in writing this book is something that had actually never caught my attention before, which is that in working in clinical writings that work with people who are normatively gendered, people would, kind of a clinician, psychoanalyst, theorist, think a lot about trauma and think a lot about how somebody acquires their cisgender. Like, I mean, we're only talking about literatures right now and bibliographies that talk about cisness. So that you have clinicians writing about kind of like an absent father and how that informs the daughter's femininity or her heterosexuality, or a mother who is overbearing and how that informs the son's identification with the father. So we began to notice that something that I had actually said in print was not right. I had said, well, why pay attention to transness when we don't do so with cisness? But then I came to realize that is actually not true. We do that all the time. The difference is that when we do that with cisness, we don't do it with an eye towards changing one's gender. We do it with an eye towards articulating the texture that the person's gender has. So you can be...
I'll just repeat that back to make sure I'm hearing it correctly. I think you're saying that when we look at the role of trauma in informing diverse gender identities, such as non-binary, trans, etc., we tend to look at it from the perspective of how has that caused that and therefore how can we undo it. But when we're looking at the way trauma informs cis identities, we're more likely to look at it in terms of how does that support those identities or how does it add
or
texture and richness?
How has that added, like, why is a particular man like so kind of like gentler or more intense about his masculinity or more anxious about his masculinity? And how does that kind of like how might trauma inform a woman's capacity to negotiate her femininity well in her relationship with other women, like questions of female envy or competitiveness or self-assertion? All of these are gendered questions, right? And when it comes to cis people, we have a lot of latitude for thinking about how trauma can become part of the formation of gender. Okay. But when we think about gender queer people, I mean, this one of my pet peeves around kind of like these conversations is that those of us who think progressively about gender have left the trauma discourse to the right and to the conservative right. So that we have had a lot to say about the trauma of transphobia, the trauma of like binary and assigned gender at birth formations. But when it comes to questions like, could traumatic experience inflect one's gender? Our answer has always been, no, what are you talking about? This is all like just core gender identity. Trauma has nothing to do with it. The right, of course, has had everything to say about gender. And their arguments usually go in the direction of, see, there's the trauma. And what you see in the, what we encounter in the new formations of gender is a degraded gender. It's a false gender. It's a symptom of the trauma. And part of our intervention is to argue that all gender is actually a way of dealing with trauma. Cisgender, transgenders, non-binary genders, all genders are outgrowths of what happens when the psyche is forced to respond to traumatic experience that happens to bigger or lesser degree to all of us. And from that perspective, we need not be so anxious or scared about thinking about whether injurious experiences have actually become folded into our gender. Like, for example, I sit in the clinic with patients who worry that, for example, have undergone like a really traumatic experience and then notice that after the traumatic experience, something about their gender begins to shift. And they feel very anxious about that. Like, maybe I'm not truly trans, or they begin to actually go back and line up their histories. Well, I may have noticed it after that, but I think it was always there. I mean, sometimes it is there from earlier on, but I also see patients rewrite their own histories, trying to make things more coherent. And we have wanted to offer the resource of complexity, meaning the resource of being able to think about trauma as also forcing the psyche to respond in a way that produces new genders, to extend that resource also to queer and trans people, as opposed to having only one narrative about it, which is that trauma disrupts you, it disrupts your gender. And if your gender has taken a different path after a traumatic experience, then that means that your gender is not legitimate or it's not valid. And if you treat the trauma, you're going to cure the gender. Here, our model is more about how to take gender, whatever gender may accrue in the aftermath of traumatic experience, to take it seriously. And we have a lot of conversations in the book with clinical material, with theory, with cultural objects about why those are genders that are valid and legitimate and are worth our trust and our support as clinicians. Like, we have a whole chapter called Taking Sides, and we argue about why it's important for the clinician to take sides and to take sides not with one or the other gender. Again, we don't believe that there's a true gender, but with the patient's own autonomous self-invention in response to life experiences and to traumatic experience.
I'm thinking a little humorously of what it might look like if the conservative right was to look at the traumas that I've got an example of I'm using cis male gender identity as an example that's jumping to mind. It would be so interesting if we were to use the experiences of, say, war and the like as a way, as seeing that as a thing that creates this more, I don't know, hyper masculine or emotionally shut down version of manhood. It would be amazing if we were to see that as an errant thing and creating a problematic gender identity rather than having that as such a normal, perfectly acceptable run of things. I don't know, just bouncing around a few funny concepts and flipping what it would be like if we applied that kind of thinking that's often applied to gender exploring folks to cis.
Yeah, and to begin to think about cisness as also involving constriction.
Yeah.
In some ways, and being a response to trauma, not always necessarily a good response to trauma. So I actually, kind of like what you're saying, like we don't even have to think of it as fun. It's actually quite a serious proposition to flip the lens and move it from the gaze being all focused on the non-normative subject And to take that which non-normative subjects bring to the conversation as a way of also trying to understand cisness and trying to understand the center, which is actually a very psychoanalytic method. Like, this is what how Freud started. He started with taking what he used to call kind of like the perversity, a word that we might even use actually in a non-pathologizing way, taking perversity and actually using it to understand the center. What if we understood the center as also kind of like suffering from versions of constriction? So I really like your question.
Nice. And am I also understanding, if I picked up some of your words correctly just now, you said, I think, that you don't necessarily believe in true gender? What was your words
yes.
there? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or a core gender identity is a
core
is
gender.
A formal term. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I guess looking at it from a psychoanalytical perspective, we all are who we are, or rather we are all trying to become our, I don't know, more in touch evolved self or something like that, and we have a whole sprawling series of experiences through life that'll either like support us to get more in touch with our true self or not. And it's almost like a game of can we find who we actually are as a person. Would you agree with that, and does gender sort of fit with that?
I wouldn't actually, because I think that even though sometimes we arrive at something that we feel was always there, or it feels like it wasn't always there, but once you're there, you're like, oh my God, that's it. That's where I need to be. That's absolutely valid on the level of individual experience. But again, like from many different angles, our pressure is precisely on this idea that there is a core self, a true self that we are moving towards. Because here's the problem. If there's a true self, you can get it right and you can get it wrong. And you asked me earlier, like, do I have it right that you think that there's no true gender? You do have it right. And what I would add to that sentence needs to be accompanied by, there's also no wrong gender. There's no right gender and there's no wrong gender. Like, right and wrong have nothing to do with gender. And we need to let go of that idea. So when we're told that this gender is wrong and we answer, no, it's right, we may be doing something that we understand as being more liberatory or more fighting for kind of like a more expansive right. But in fact, what we're doing is we are accepting the terms of putting gender on a continuum of right or wrong. And we just need to refuse, however seductive it may be, however we may think that we're doing good work, by saying, no, 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 it's right. Let us have it because it's right. There's nothing wrong with it. Like, we are kind of like digging kind of like pretty serious holes that we're going to end up falling into down the line in being so attached to the notion of right and wrong gender. Gender has nothing to do with rightness or wrongness. It has to do with experience. It has to do with autonomy. It has to do with culture and with materials that we have to engage with that precede us and we have not chosen and we have not consented to them, but we nevertheless have to live with them. These are all different kinds of conditions to think about gender rather than what to me seems like a pretty impoverished either or binary way of right or wrongness about gender.
Yeah. I am guessing you're also not a huge fan of the idea of a soulmate.
Yes, I am not.
Yes, I see people pursuing that model getting absolutely caught up in the question of, is this the right or the wrong person for me? Yeah,
that doesn't mean that there are people who are not the right people for us, but there are many right people, and nobody is 100% right anyway. Plus, we're constantly evolving. Like, I mean, that's the whole other point that you were speaking to earlier.
It's like I study a stream of conflict resolution, which only ever hopes for resolution in the moment, because as soon as you get resolution, it shifts 5 seconds later into the next part of the topic. And likewise, the right partner or partners at the time, or the right gender identity, perhaps.
And then there are people who have been together for like 60 years. They kind of like met as sweethearts and they live the rest of their lives together, and that's lovely too. Like, there's many ways to be in this world.
I like the analogy of every person that you interact with, and that is potentially relationship material. It's almost like a game to see if you can find the unique structure that's perfect for the two of you. And it may look nothing like anything conventional, or it may look, as you say, like the people who have been together, let's assume monogamously for 60 years, and it just looks great on them, but not for everyone.
Not for everyone. I think that's the thing that takes us back to the conversation we're having earlier about control.
Please say more.
Well, controlling other people's narratives or controlling, trying to control what's normal for others, what's healthy for others, oftentimes under the guise of protectionism. One of like some of the most dangerous, pernicious, damaging interventions we've seen, especially when it comes to children, have happened under the guise of protecting them. Like, and protecting children is actually a very racialized concept. And like, whenever we talk about protection, we also have to be thinking with multiple different discourses. We can't think, of course, about gender without thinking about coloniality. Like the binary gender system has always been a colonial system that has been imposed as a civilizing project on those conquered by the West. I mean, we can think a lot about kind of like communities that have traditionally understood gender to exist on multiple levels, but have been compressed into two genders as a project of kind of like being westernized.
We should finish up soon. I'm kind of curious. I don't have this question in a neat, orderly format with words that are in a linear, understandable fashion. So maybe can we just workshop this question a little bit? You've written previously around some things of how trauma can inform kink and BDSM and pursuit of adventurous forms of sexuality. So, like, my question is sort of along the lines of how do people or therapists pick the difference between healthy, adventurous play and exploring, and dangerous, sort of bad versions of consent. But that's not quite the question I want to ask. I want to ask on something about how you think trauma informs our interests and pursues in kink, and how that's healthy or not healthy. But having blurted that whole string of words out, if there's just like any combination of them you want to put together to make a sentence that you'd like to answer, that'd be great.
That is very open-ended,
Very open.
delightfully open-ended. I'm trying to think because I have a whole entire book that works actually with the same premise of traumatophilia that we work with in Gender Without Identity. The concept that we are not just broken by our traumata, that we are not just disrupted and undone by them, but that in response to traumatic experience, the psyche is forced to do something with it. And part of the argument that I make in my book, Sexuality Beyond Consent, is that the disturbance that comes with trauma can oftentimes have kind of like very strong erotic energies. And therefore we see people engage, like I've been writing a lot about race play, which is a very particular niche kind of fetish that involves kind of like the play with racial stereotypes and re the repeating of like the, I'm going to put consensual in terms that they're formally consented upon, but the repeating of some of the worst violences that have happened in kind of like in history for the purpose of sexual pleasure. And then the question becomes, what are these people doing? The easy answer is leave them alone, or they're doing nothing, like they're doing whatever they want to do as long as they're consenting. There's nothing to see here, keep walking. Or like these people are sick, there's something wrong, why would anybody want that? We should fix it.
Re-traumatizing.
They're re-traumatizing themselves, they're kind of like the trope of the rubric of repetition compulsion, which is like psychoanalytic concept, comes up, like, oh, they're just repeating this thing because they're stuck in it. And what I try to do in my in Sexuality Beyond Consent is talk about how repetition does not just is not just a mechanical, the repeating of these kinds of scenarios is not just a mechanical fixation, but that it can also force some things to return, force some things to come back. so that they can be experienced and revisited. And that is a way of thinking about like diverse sexual pleasures that do not map onto what we usually think of as sex, and which traverse out into domains that some people might not even recognize as sexual, but which can feel very, very erotic to some individuals.
It's funny because the therapeutic community understands things like narrative therapy and psychodrama. So the reliving of previous experiences in a controlled situation where effectively, like, those therapies wouldn't use the phrase safe words, but where you've effectively got safe words in place and where you can retell the ending into different directions and so forth. Mm-hmm. And we recognize the therapeutic benefit of those approaches in a lot of other realms, but suddenly that sort of cuts off when we're talking about sexuality and kink and BDSM.
Yeah. I mean, I actually have a very particular take on safe words and consent from that angle. So I don't know if you want to get into this in this episode, because that's a very long discussion.
Oh, how about if I say I'm green for a short take, shortish take on that? Is it possible we can do a short version of that?
Sure, I can try.
Or possibly we come back and have another episode at some stage in the future. But
actually, that might be a good idea.
All right. Well, that sounds like an idea that's definitely worth pursuing. Mm-hmm. So just, I guess, in terms of closing today, is there anything else you'd like to say about anything we've spoken about or clarify anything or just any last closing thoughts?
Yeah, there is something I want to say, which is that psychoanalysis is not on many people's radars. And especially for queer and trans people, like, that is very well deserved, because psychoanalysis has done a terrible job for a very long time working with these communities, so that it's very understandable. And I certainly have a very strong critique of our field. But if you're wondering, why should I care about psychoanalysis? Like, who cares? There's two reasons to care. The one is that some of the most powerful anti-trans activism at this moment is happening by psychoanalysts. Psychoanalysts are at the leading edge of what is happening both in Australia, for sure, in the United States, and in the UK. So the Organization for the Study of Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, SEGEM, which is getting constantly cited in some of the anti-trans legislation in the US, its president is an Australian psychoanalyst. So, you know, like, we need to be interested in that, because that's where some of the pushback comes from. The other reason to be interested is because, however problematically it's been deployed, psychoanalysis gives us so many resources to go beyond even the right or wrongness of gender that we're talking about earlier, and to actually go in direct, to speak about invention, to speak about experimentation, to speak about change in ways that other discourses do not give us. So it's also extremely rich. And for that reason, my co-author and I want to fight for it, even as we see the problems with it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. And if I could chuck in my own personal experience there for a moment, I've been studying psychotherapy and psychoanalysis for 25 years myself. It is, it is my way. It is my, to the extent that I'm ever going to meet my gods, it is psychoanalysis. But my own experience there has been very mixed, in that I was shamed out of my community, mostly relating to being a sex worker and various other aspects of my gender and sexual identity. Yet at the same time, there's no way I could be doing what I do in the world and be as comfortable in my sexuality and gender pursuits as I am if it wasn't for, I think I'm up to about 600 or 700 hours of therapy dash receiving now. Mm-hmm. So I also just want to personally come in and both wave a flag of yay and also wave a flag of caution. And I guess I would support listeners to please do a search amongst your respective communities for lists of therapists and counselors who have been vetted, because you really don't want to go through the process of having to train your therapist in things that are fundamental and important to you. And this extends to stuff like poly as well. It's very hard to get a counsellor genuinely on board with the nuances of poly. So check your local communities. For those of you that are in Australia, Curious Creatures runs a list of counsellors that I have vetted who are across the things we've been talking about. But most gender and sexuality communities maintain some kind of a list of therapists who are at least a tick in the box for understanding these things.
What an important point that you're making, that kind of like both the possibility and the heartbreak that comes with kind of like doing all of this work, and sex work is also something that has been not just criminalized but pathologized, and it makes it hard for sex workers to be able to talk about their complex experiences if they constantly have to defend what they're doing. I mean, it's a labor issue. It's not just an issue of thinking about sex. It's also thinking about an issue of thinking about labor.
Yes. And it breaks my heart around, like, particularly when you're a part of a minority identity, my God, you need psychotherapeutic support. So it's just such a tragedy that that is the very thing that keeps so many people out, as you say, for very understandable reasons.
But as you said, like, there's also, like, there are good therapists out there. There are people who can work with a range of these issues. It's always better to have a referral from somebody who has worked personally or knows somebody who has worked personally with a clinician, because how people describe themselves in regards to their work is not necessarily what you'll get. So cross-check your references and don't let that discourage you from getting good therapy. It can change your life. It can really change your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, huzzah to that. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your perspectives and insights, Avi. It's been a very enjoyable chat. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'd love to hear what you thought about today's episode. I've created a forum so you can tell me and also chat with other listeners about it. It's at forum.curiouscreatures.biz, and there's a link for that in the show notes. Once you've signed up to the forum, which is free and takes less than a minute, navigate to groups and then join the group for curious conversations about sex. And if you liked today's episode, please share it with someone else that might be interested. There's probably a share button right there in your podcast player. Curious Creatures run a variety of workshops, mostly in Melbourne, Australia. We've also got some pre-recorded workshops that you can watch anytime, anywhere. Our workshops are on sexuality, self-development, and relationships. You might also want to check out our consent cards. They're a small plastic card with all of the questions you need to ask to give yourself the best chance of getting exactly what you want to the level you want it. There's a version specifically for kink activities and a more general version for everything else. Links to our consent cards are in the show notes. See you soon, friends.